right, great. Well, thank you so much, Professor Aisha Wilson Carter, for being here. Just a little background intro. She was my professor for university writing, human rights at Columbia, and she was a great professor. taught me so much. So thank you so much for being here, for Blacklining. And I guess we'll just jump into the questions. So my first question is, you are one of the founders of the Long Island Strong Schools Alliance. So why did you start LISSA?
Very good. Thank you. So thanks first of all, Gianna, for having me here. Absolutely. I appreciate that I was a good professor. You were an amazing student with the contribution of your perspective to class discussions was great. So specifically, the Long Island Strong School Alliance, we actually started out as a Facebook group, which was Parents for Diversity, Equity, Inclusion in Long Island. And really, our founder, Amanda Cohenstein, is used to doing grassroots activism and work, but really, it was just kind of the groundswell of parents. And so we were seeing what was going on at these Board of Ed meetings. Many of us who had been involved in DEI initiatives just the year before in 20, the summer of 2020. So we were really kind of taken aback by all the toxic misinformation and just kind of outright disrespect and threatening that was going on at the Board of Ed meetings. So we really decided to make it come together and kind of make it our mission to support policies, specifically diversity, equity, inclusion, social emotional learning, and really just to be able to educate the community on why these initiatives are so important. So just kind of a counter narrative to the narrative that was going on at the time.
Just as like a follow-up, what did those board meetings kind of look like? Like what was going on? Like what was the narrative that was happening, in the
So you can see tons of YouTube videos, and actually they did an SNL skit. And it's really something that was happening across the country. And so a lot of places like Long Island, a lot of us were really surprised, but not surprised, but at the narrative, but really railing against any and everything they decided to call critical race theory. Not even understanding the definition of that. But more importantly, what they were doing is putting anything underneath that umbrella. And that's a it was it's a real it was a real tactical effort to do this, to be to have a way to kind of start at the grassroots as far as voting is concerned. So and wanting to push that kind of extreme right narrative. We're not even going to say Republican or conservative. This is really came from the extreme right, but it's just kind of been more broadly adopted.
So you started LISSA, but I want to hear more about your kind of origins with educational activism. Like, how did you get into that?
I would say that I was talking to a colleague earlier today, and really from the classroom, from being in the classroom and my kind of unique background in academia, what I mean is that I work across several institutions in several different types of roles. So throughout my career, I have worked with Ivy League students, I've worked with community college students, adult students, freshman undergraduate students, graduate students, right? So being able to work with all different types of student populations really kind of allowed me the kind of front seat and firsthand experiences with what students were facing and the challenges, things that worked well from them, and being able to look at that in a broad picture. So that really got me into academic support because I was looking at where was the institution falling short when it comes to student belonging, student retention, career development, all of these things that are important to students, where was the institution falling short? So that really is how I started to get into education activism. And then obviously looking at the equity within education, you know, from higher ed down to K through 12. And so I then just started doing whatever I could at the institutions, whether it was involved in the union, whether initiating DEI initiatives within the school, starting task force, writing proposals. I just basically decided that this was the area that I felt like I needed, my most attention needed to go to.
Yeah, clearly you've seen students of all kinds, and you're a mom yourself, right? So would you say that was another big like influence? Like, how has motherhood influenced your activism?
It's right. It's part of what I'm doing. A large part of it is for their future. Right. The idea that they would be growing up in an environment that's more hostile than I was growing up in is alarming because we're, you know, not only stopping progression, but we're actually reverting with how people have been emboldened with their just kind of basic outright racism, that it is, we moved past a point where that sort of thing was just readily acceptable, but we're back there again. So the idea that I could have a, you know, 11-year-old or, you know, at the time, 9-year-old and a 3-year-old growing up in an environment that was more hostile than the one I grew up in, you have to do something, you know, I have to kind of offer whatever it is I can. And my positionality is offering, you know, looking at it through a scholarly lens, basically, right? Because of the research and the things that I do. And so whatever I can bring to the table and contribute to moving us forward as a country is what I want to do. And it's definitely for my children and other children and future generations, for your generation, right? We want to make those changes and have them be sustainable. So absolutely, motherhood plays an important part.
Yeah. It's obviously, there's been racism in America since its inception. But I was a little surprised to hear that your experience growing up, that you think that things now are getting worse than ever. What do you think, like, this started, like, this reversion?
It started with the election of Barack Obama. So from my from the perspective I'm coming at, what I think happened is for certain people, the election and presidency of a Black man in America and their, and people who see it as their country was a disrespect to the presidency itself and an offense to some people. So I think what happened is thereafter, because more than half of the population decided that this was the person for the job and elected Barack Obama, they decided that if you disrespect the presidency like that, we'll tear the whole thing down rather than move forward to a place of, you know, a post-racial society, if that ever will exist. A lot of people thought we were there with the election of Barack Obama, but there was a swelling happening underneath. A lot of people, and they expressed it then and throughout his presidency, but it was still not as acceptable as it is now. And so that's what I mean by different, right? So I'm late 80s, 90s. It was kind of, right, there's an ebb and flow of society. And so we were at kind of a different stage. It just wasn't maybe the very first thing or top of mind thing that people were experiencing. There was still political correctness and that sort of thing. So I think that's what makes it different for my children now, that people could, his classmates' parents are railing against having diverse authors being discussed in the classroom. That's something that I didn't experience.
Yeah, that totally makes sense, because I know a lot of people that I would know and talk to and just that I've grown up around think that it started with Donald Trump. But it makes sense that the election of Barack Obama was kind of the buildup, and all of it was like boiling under the surface, maybe not so under the surface, but it all kind of came like raging out when he got elected. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, and the important thing too is that it's always there. That's also the thing, right? So there are just times where we can kind of hide it under the rug a little bit more and a little bit better. And there are times like now where we're gonna just put it front and center. So yeah.
So what are your thoughts on the conversation around critical race theory? And do you think that the national reaction to it affected the reaction to DEI in the Long Island School District and just in the country as a whole?
Yeah. So my thoughts on critical race theory. You know, my thoughts is that it's a theory. It's a theory of law. We use it in academics as well, just essentially to kind of describe the where race might intersect with curriculum, with higher, with all of those things. And that's what it is. It's something that's been around, but no one paid attention to it at all. And it is definitely different than diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, right? It differs in that, but the premise of maybe why we have it is explained in critical race theory, because it is about trying to look at the structures, processes, and things that are in place, right? And where do we see racism play out in those areas and functions? So what happened is, like, there was a really concerted effort to put everything underneath this scary umbrella called critical race theory. And it was very clear and purposeful. Some extreme right wingers have wrote about it and said this is what they were gonna do, and they absolutely did it, was to get into the local communities by way of Board of Ed education meetings and different boards and present this boogeyman called critical race theory. And then anything that made anybody uncomfortable or upset or made them think too hard or use their critical thinking skills they were going to put it under there and put it under that umbrella to make it untouchable. And so the other thing that's important about critical race theory is just like, as I said about Barack Obama being the catalyst, right? The summer of 2020 and the racial reckoning that came with that summer and the amount of people who were participating, who became a part of the conversation, the amount of allies we that movement gained, some people were really upset about that. So this backlash of critical race theory was a direct assault on the racial reckoning of 2020.
Yeah, because that summer was so full of like educational reckonings for many, many people. And that kind of leads me to my next question. I'm getting into it a little like faster than I thought I would, but like it just reminds me of in your writing, you define something called the American lie. And that's kind of like what brought it to mind, like people finding out that the American lie ran so deep, or maybe that it even existed in the first place. So like, how do you define the American lie?
Yeah, it's funny, you know, when we talk about the big lie now, we're talking about like the farce that the election of 2020 was stolen. And I always say to myself, I'm like, but there's the bigger lie that allowed even this to happen. And so I think the American lie is based on the premise that we are either superior or inferior based on race as number one. That's the first thing we classify people as in this country. And then we go to class, we go to gender, and every other identity factor, sexual orientation, all of these things, right? Whether they're, you know, whether they are a citizen, right, or not, like all of these things, right, is how we start to classify people. And the American lie says that people are inferior or superior based on to what categories they fall into. This is not a lie that's just kind of isolated to America, but America has a unique approach in this American lie. And I think that that's why we would kind of term it the American lie. And it's because it recognizes how fragile that superiority is because it's not true. So it has to consistently build and create new avenues to keep the lie going. And so that's why we have all of these systems of oppression, because America, we need for there to be a subservient class. And the easiest way and the way that this country started was to do that based on race. So it doesn't want to let that go because it is the easiest distinction that we can make so that we have that hierarchy, and that hierarchy remains in place. But it's all a lie. So here we're telling white people they're superior, we're telling Black people they're inferior, and wherever you fall in the middle of those categories, right, is how superior or inferior you are, is the closer to whiteness you are, right? But that's not true. And so when people start living their lives and they realize that that's not the truth, it is a letdown, it is a loss of control. People can react a lot of different ways to that. And so that's why I say that lie affects everyone. It's not just harmful to people of color. It's harmful to all of us because it's just not true. And so when you realize it's not true, you have a lot of different reactions. And one of those reactions is to try to maintain that idea or lie of superiority. And so you'll do whatever you can to maintain that.
Yeah, the educational system is so influential in its unique power to counteract that lie from a young age. And yeah, these people in the board meetings doing so much to keep that from happening, you know, that's kind of like part of that cycle of maintenance and maintenance and maintenance that's been going on.
Yeah.
Forever. but for the Black population, the Black American population, obviously this lie causes a lot of trauma. So in your piece, Black Trauma 101, you point out the three options of dealing with this trauma of being Black in America. And option one, and you can kind of go a little bit over the options, but in option one, the best out of the three is option one, where they become diligent citizens who persistently fight injustice and never shy away from uncomfortable conversations. And, you know, especially this summer, there's been rising, or 2020, it's 2 years later, with the rising conversations about activist fatigue and the large burden placed on people of color to educate their white counterparts. I wonder, like, what do these issues mean to the option one crowd?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. And because first I hadn't thought about, I think about that fatigue all the time. I talk about it in workshops and stuff. So that I did, but thinking about it in relationship to that option. And I think when I talk about that option, I'm thinking at the idea of being diligent and the idea of never shying away from uncomfortable conversations and confronting these things head on. Is exactly, I think, if you remember, we read Coates' piece, right? Ta-Nehisi Coates' piece. So it is that idea of fully being awake, accepting, and knowing what this entire situation is. Not to be ashamed of it, not to, as an option two, fill yourself with hate, right? So that you can't move on and be a productive person in society. So if you can fully acknowledge it, fully be awake, fully understand the situation and find a way to bring your whole self everywhere you go and be proud of that and not shameful of the experiences and our past, because we know we don't believe the lie. We're not inferior, right? So know that. So that I think is what I mean behind option one. And that will look different sometimes. Sometimes that will put you in the front line of a protest, but sometimes you're gonna have to take care of your own mental health and you will have to pull back. And this work in general is exhausting for everyone. So we all have to tap out at some point in time and like combat, you know, you switch with the people in the front line, right? They only stay there for a certain amount of time. So I think we have to get into that habit with people within the movement, allies, right? All of these things, we have to get in that habit of kind of maybe switching off, leaning on each other, because there is a real fatigue that happens. And especially, you know, definitely for someone of color, you know, I, as a Black woman, I'm, you know, I'm obviously personally invested in this, but because I also see it, that this is so harmful to all of us, that it's for all of society, right? So it's my service. And so I see it as that, like, this is my service to my community. But yes, the fatigue is real. And I think that for that option one crowd, it's really just understanding that full situation and never shying away from bringing their whole self, owning it and not being ashamed. And then the third option to me, as I say in my piece, is the most dangerous because it helps perpetuate the lie. And that's when Black people themselves take in the lie, they buy into it. And if the game is to gain more power, more money, more greed, more prestige, and to not be inferior, then they will make decisions in order just to be a part of that fold. So yeah, so option one for me is still the best option.
Yeah, and I kind of like am thinking, like, considering the three options, like, just the idea lying under the surface that you have to face, like, the truth and undergo this fatigue, like, kind of may or may not influence someone's decision to, or not even a decision, but like an unconscious need to maintain the lie within themselves, even though it does not benefit at all. Yeah, because it's so, it's just an overwhelming concept, you know?
Yeah, it's daunting, right? It's daunting. And that's why people make that decision, because, and that's why I feel like it's the most preferable for society, right? For the people themselves, like, it is, it's exhausting, you know, and to be fully aware, right? And to acknowledge it, but it's also freeing in a way that all of the things that you go through feeling inferior, to just understand and be fully aware and make a commitment to bring your whole self everywhere is freeing. Mm-hmm. You no longer have to kind of carry that stigma around, even though other people might try to put that on you. You don't have it internally anymore. And that is what, to me, is freeing. So the fight to get people to kind of realize that might be tiring for me, but again, like I said, this is my service.
Like, I really like resonated with like what Ta-Nehisi Coates said about like staying awake is like all we have, because there's so much hate around, you know, that, you know, I was kind of sheltered from growing up, and, you know, all of a sudden, like, being able to see it everywhere is tiring, and it's a lot, but it's like the only way to be, you know. Yeah, it really resonated with me.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. That's awesome. Me too. That's it. There are pieces, like I say, in times where, like, it's like, that's exactly it, right? That's what's going on. You're able to identify, who, you know, what it really is. The kind of, I guess the kind of weight of the situation, but it is the only other thing is to buy the lie. You know, like, that's the only other way. And no, we can't buy the lie anymore. Mm-hmm. It's been too long.
Yeah. So in your writing, you often compare the system of white supremacy in America as an addiction. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that and like how you came up with that metaphor.
Yeah, I was thinking that's interesting. The addiction part, I was thinking about thinking about that a little bit more now too, because I have some distance. I think it is, so if we say, right, what's important is power, money, prestige, right? We live in a capitalist society. It is about, the hierarchy, right? And gaining, gaining kind of as much as you can, essentially, right? As much as you can to kind of set that this is your place in the world and society and as a measure of success. So as I was saying before, this means that we have to have someone always under in order to be above, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the addiction is that it's always about that competition. It's always about that success. It's always about more money, right? And so if someone tells you, you have the basic or the least you can expect from this country is that you are on top, right? That you are, as far as the hierarchy is concerned, you are here. Even if personally you don't have the money, you don't have this is the one advantage you can always kind of count on, is that you are up here as far as the hierarchy is concerned. No matter how much money, power those other people below you have, you are still here. So that's an addiction for some people, because not some people, but that is trying to maintain that order and that whatever they think is tangible, with that kind of being the lay of the land, right? That the white man is the first, right? And everything else is thereafter. You want to hold on to that. You will do anything to hold on to that kind of false, right, opportunity or advantage that you have. It's fleeting. It's not even real. And so that's too why they want you to buy into the lie, because then you won't believe that anymore if you know the truth, right? So it's all of these things, and it's an addiction. It is like we have to have this system. This is what the system was built on. We have to maintain this, right? Because they just can't see a way of it being different, a way of it being actually equal, that every person is equal. They just can't see what that would look like, what that would mean to give away that advantage. And that's a real human thing. So when I say it's an addiction, that's a human kind of thing. Mm-hmm. To say, hey, I'm gonna ask you to give up this one opportunity or one advantage you have, right? You can understand why people be like, no, I don't want to give that up. I don't want to do that because I don't know what that would mean for me. So that I think is what's addictive to it. And I think everyone buys into it. And so even Black people themselves buy into that, because they think that if I can just be seen differently, I will set myself apart, right? I will have a status or a success as far as how we measure it. And I think a lot of it is just what we measure as valuable in this country: money, power, right? And it's not just this country, but if that's what we're valuing, that's number one, we cannot be surprised when people will do anything to keep that or gain that. And so I think it comes down to what we're valuing or what we say we value.
Yeah, and just like from a biological standpoint, like in the body, what addiction looks like, not that I'm a biologist, but just from what like I know about addiction, it's like your body adopts a new equilibrium and you have to keep taking and taking and taking to maintain this new equilibrium, even though it's not like the natural state of the body. And mm-hmm. like you have to go to withdrawals to get over it. And, you know, I think a lot of people fear this withdrawal, this metaphorical withdrawal, because there will be consequences once everybody like learns this, you know.
Yeah,
it's not an easy process by any means. So I just think that's like a very like astute metaphor for like what this looks like. Like,
yeah, and that's the withdrawal, right? We went through a withdrawal after or during the election of President Obama and his whole entire presidency. We saw how bad things could get for 4 years and we're like, oh, okay, we don't want to do that. But here we are again in a withdrawal, like, oh, 2020 happened. It was like, whoa, everyone's awake. And then it's like, oh no, I'm losing this again. Let's not lose this. They couldn't imagine getting fully clean, right? They couldn't imagine going through the full rehab. So, and that's what happens. It's basically America keeps checking itself out of rehab. Like, right? That's what's happening.
And like, what do you think like the metaphorical rehab and like road to healing would look like?
It would look like truth and education. That is the first thing. We wonder why after generation, it doesn't change. Oh, well, this generation is more mixed. This generation is more accepting. Every generation, every younger generation has been that way. Every single one. What happens is people grow up. Because our society is so segregated, you go move into your own neighborhoods. Your kids go to school with maybe one or two. And if you're not working in a profession where you meet different people, where like something like academia and diversity, equity, and inclusion is at the forefront of it, right? And you're not experiencing these things, then you're not. And then you're gonna start tuning in to whatever it is you want, you gather your news from. You start reading, depending on what your profession is, you stop reading as much, right? So this is why when they're like, oh, everyone needs a college education, that's not the answer either, because you go to college and you just gotta just so happen to get involved in this in college. You could go through your whole college career and not be bothered with any of this kind of, these kind of conversations and discussions. So it has to start with where we are mandating people to go to school. That's K through 12. That whole curriculum has to change. And what businesses and corporations have been doing is great, because it has to change in corporation and businesses. And we see that. And that's great. We have to recognize we're a part of a global economy and a global world, right? That's what it looks like. Recognize that. And so how do we contribute to it as Americans, right? What can we bring to that table? We have to stop just like being so, I think as we said, like just that scaredness of change and difference, like that's what's gonna save us. That's what's gonna, help us thrive, not the opposite. So to me, that's what healing looks like, and where it starts in education, because then your kids are educated. Hopefully the parents are also then being educated as well. And good districts. The conversations are open. The participation is good. We have a full teacher-parent connection. And then that, like I said, that curriculum and that representation, getting different diverse teachers in front of students, and teaching the truth about history. Like, it is beyond me that Texas has a different way of describing and defining the Alamo than New York. You know, why, like, what are we doing? It's 2022. Like, are we really playing pretend still? You know, like, this is what I mean. Like, we have, there's no other way to justify it. You're justifying because we want Texans to think this. You know, not what actually happened. We want people to think this. Like, that's not a curriculum. That's propaganda. We got to get the propaganda out of school and just tell the truth. That's it. Said, you know, to me, that's the first place.
Yeah, I completely agree. And like, I just remember being taught about like history in my schools, like in California, even, which is like supposedly very liberal, you know, and like there's a lot of things that like I didn't know. They don't teach about like Juneteenth in school, which is really important. You know, I would have liked to know that, like, you know, when we're learning about like all these like milestones in history, in American history, but like even such a big thing, so like as Juneteenth, like they don't teach it because it helps crack, you know, helps crack through the lie a little bit, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it wasn't a clean, like, easy, like, oh, everyone's free now, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, that's just, like, what it brought to mind. And going back to, like, what you said about, like, being, like, in a more mixed society, I know we talked, like, a little bit about this in class when we were, like, reading Race's class, and, like, the idea that, like, oh, like, you know, everyone's going to be mixed eventually. And like that'll solve all the problems, which obviously, like, no, and like we shouldn't strive for that either. Mm-hmm. So like, what are your thoughts on like that kind of like conception of like a post-racial society?
Yeah, it's a farce. It's make believe, because it doesn't deal with the issue. You know, the idea that, you know, everyone will be mixed and that's gonna solve anything, it's not, because like if we're thinking about racist class, it's said all throughout, right? And that we use race, right, as the classifier, right, that determines the hierarchy. So, you know, you have two spectrums, where do you fall within the spectrum, right? And that's where you fall as far as your kind of status in society. So if we do that, mix, the more mixed we are just means that they're in the middle of the spectrum, right? We haven't done anything about these two issues. We just have more people in the middle. You're like, what? So it doesn't deal with the fact that it's wrong to have, right, for race to be that classifier and what determines someone's status in society. That's the problem. That's what we have to deal with. It's not just like, oh, give in to the problem by just being more mixed, right? So, and that's why we will always be here. We will always come back here if we do not address the issues. We don't address the truth. If we don't stay awake, we will always come back here. I don't know what a post-racial society looks like. I don't think identifying races and ethnicities though are wrong. So that's another thing. I don't know what a post-racist society I hope we get to, but will there be a time where we don't identify people by race at all? I don't think that's possible. It's here, you know, like it's here. And I don't think that that's necessary either. That's kind of the color blindness. Like, it's not necessary to pretend like we don't exist and we have differences and experiences. Let's learn about them and celebrate them, whatever they are, you know? Why can't we do that? Why does it have to be either ignore it or, you know, hate it? Why can't it be a celebration of those differences?
Well, that is all the questions I have. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on this.
So yeah. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
No problem. I'm just so honored, you know, to have you on Blacklining. Really means so much. And I hope that a lot of people can hear your thoughts on this because
yeah, and I'm very impressed and very happy that you guys have taken on this project and you're doing what you're doing as far as your contribution and impact. Like, that's amazing. Continue that well into adulthood. Please, 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 because that's what we need. So yeah, very, very good. Thank you so much.
Thank you.